ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. This week, I'm talking with Dwight Hurst about director Franklin J. Schaffner's 1968 sci-fi drama Planet of the Apes, which recently screened nationwide as part of TCM and Fathom Events year-long series to bring classic films to the big screen. The story of Planet of the Apes follows an astronaut named Taylor, played by Charlton Heston, whose ship crashes on a mysterious planet populated by apes. Intent on getting back home, Taylor convinces two of the ape scientists, played by Kim Hunter and Roddy McDowall, that humans have always been intelligent, capable of speech, and were once the dominant species.
Discover Planet of the Apes, a civilization where humans run wild in the jungles. The superior beings are apes.
Tribunal has placed you in my custody for final disposition. Do you realize what that means? No. Emasculation, to begin with. Then experimental surgery on the speech centers, on the brain. Then a kind of living death.
Based on a 1963 French novel entitled Les Planètes des Singes, pardon my French, by Pierre Boulez, the script was originally penned by Twilight Zone creator Rod Serling.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight. A dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
Unfortunately, Serling's draft was rejected due to its overabundance of special effects and an advanced ape society that would have jacked up the budget. So, blacklisted writer Michael Wilson penned the script that we ended up with, though Serling's ending was retained, which allowed him to receive screen credit.
Go get him!
Taylor! Why did you run away?
Security police!
I'm in charge of this man!
No longer, madam. He is now in the custody of the Ministry of Science.
Take your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape!
The finished product was released in April of 1968 and was well received by critics and lauded as the best film of the year, securing an honorary Oscar for John Chambers' makeup effects, as well as nominations for Best Costumes and Score. The film's success isn't surprising, as it benefits from both the crumbling Hollywood studio system, which allowed for harsher language and nudity, as well as the current political issues of the time. Debuting during the most violent year in the American Civil Rights Movement, Taylor's issues with the apes and theirs with him creates an allegory for the contentious issues between African Americans and whites. Even the various ape actors found themselves segregated during filming, and much of the movie acts as a cautionary tale about continued racial strife in a way that Rod Serling would have been proud of, even in spite of his limited involvement.
Good morning, Dr. Zira.
Good morning, Julius. How's our patient today?
No change. The minute you open the door, he goes into his act.
Well, and what do we want this morning? Do we want something? Come on, speak. Come on, speak. Do we want some sugar, old-timer? Hmm?
You could get hurt doing that, doctor.
Oh, don't be silly. He's perfectly tame.
They're all tame until they take a chunk out of you.
Well, bright eyes. Is our throat feeling better? It still hurts, doesn't it?
See? He keeps pretending he can talk.
That bright eyes is remarkable. He keeps trying to form words.
You know what they say. Human see, human do.
TCM and Fathom Events recently paired up to present 1968's Planet of the Apes on the big screen, and my special guest and I will be discussing the film. I'd like to introduce Dwight Hurst. Dwight, how are you?
Hello! I mean, good.
That was a bad answer to your question. I'm fine. How are you, Kristen?
I am great. Thank you so much for agreeing to sit down and talk about Planet of the Apes with me.
Oh, I'm always willing to talk anything sci-fi or movie related pretty much anytime. Thanks for letting me do it on your show.
Dwight, why don't you give the listeners a little background on who you are, what you do, all that good stuff.
My name is Dwight Hurst, and I am in the podcast verse. I have a couple of shows that I do, am a part of. I'm the host and creator of the Broken Brain podcast, which is a weekly dose of mental health and psychotherapy. I'm a therapist, but that's what I do for a living. And so I do a mental health and psychology themed show that you can listen to. I also do a show called Amygdala Magazine, which is a look into storytelling and writing. It's tied to a annual short story anthology, I guess you could say, collection. We've done one so far, so that's, you know, if we do two, it'll be a tradition. It's theoretically annual at this point, but it's a little contest. People send in their short stories, and then we include them for that. So Amygdala Magazine podcast and The Broken Brain. And then I'm part of the Core Temp Arts network of podcasts. I participate with the show TV Ate My Brain as well, where we do some commentary on current and past television shows. Those are some of my podcast credentials.
What is your background with this film specifically? Had you seen it before? What is your history with Planet of the Apes as a feature film?
Well, I'll tell you, my experience was that I saw it at a young age. I mean, it's one of those classic sci-fi films. I really think everybody probably should see it if you're into sci-fi at all, because it's sort of a building block. It is a pioneer in the way of world building, twist endings. There's a lot of things watching it again that I noticed that I think we've done with modern movies that they did as well. They probably weren't the first or the only ones, but they were doing some exciting things with what was probably a pretty radical notion back then. So saw it as a young person, and then I saw it again, actually, my teenage years. My brother and I would, every week or so, we always would sit and watch a movie together. We pick out some like movies like this. We watch some old movies, some classic movies, and we ended up, I believe we watched all five of the original Planet of the Apes movies, if I remember correctly. Spoiler alert for all of those, this is the best one.
I have never seen this before. This was a first-time watch for myself. I do recall going to see the 2001 remake. That was my first Planet of the Apes introduction, so to speak, the Tim Burton remake of this movie, which, if you've seen it, it's a movie. It's not a very good movie.
It's not great, yeah. Marky Mark.
Yes, and I've seen the newer incarnation, so Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Those were really good. I liked those. I thought the one with James Franco, it's set in San Francisco, so my neck of the woods, so I was able to look at my hometown essentially being destroyed for 90 minutes by apes. That was interesting. So I kind of am seeing this in reverse with all the history already ahead of it. And I thought this was interesting. It was not the big schlocky train wreck that I kind of envisioned. Classic films like this can feel very dated, especially in sci-fi, where they're kind of hypothesizing these grand things that when you're seeing them, you know, 60 some odd years in the future, it just kind of looks passe. But I thought this was very prescient. It's very hard to look at this without seeing the implications regarding what was going on at the time with race and gender and all of that. So it's very hard to separate those two. It's very timely in that regard. Makeup effects, I think, are really great. They hold up, even though it's obvious they probably did a lot of dubbing in post because the mouths are not moving as fluidly as they should. And Charlton Heston has no business being naked in this movie more than once, which was very depressing for me since I have watched a lot of Heston films for my blog, and I have to watch Ben-Hur for this podcast in a couple of weeks. So I will be Hestoned out, and I will have that image in my head forever.
So one was your limit?
Oh my, you know it's 68, because by this point the studio code was already kind of crumbled. Foreign films had already brought nudity into the cinemas, so Hollywood's kind of getting into this new game of being able to show skin. And I can deal with Heston in a loincloth or whatever those little man panties he's wearing are, but there is a scene where he's, you know, they're skinny dipping and he's got to wander around just naked. And we got to see everybody's backside, and I did not need to see Heston ass in my life. I'm sorry to the people out there who have delicate ears, but it needs to be said. And then there's a scene later on in the movie where they just, like, rip the clothes right off him, and you have to see it again. I didn't need to see it once.
I will say, I think that they pioneered the use of strategic branch placement.
Yes,
as well,
there is so much branch placement. There's rag placement, like he's got little sheets and stuff. I want to know who had that thankless job of being sure Heston was properly covered for this movie.
You know what was really interesting to me on rewatch? Here's these guys that they crash in this spacecraft, and once they see water, they're very quick to nude up and jump in there and have seemingly no pretense. But you know what was funny? It just so worked out that after I watched that, I was talking to a guy I know who's in the military, and we weren't even talking about Planet of the Apes, but he just happened to tell me about the showering experience in basic training, how it's just basically this really small room, and you got like 60 dudes, they got to crank through there. And he said the first day or two, you're kind of like have some semblance of modesty. And then very quickly you get to the point where you just don't care because everybody's just cool with it. And how it, at some point it got to, for him, like kind of like, oh, it's kind of this human thing where you don't think so much about nudity the same way.
Which so just leads you to wonder how that spacecraft situation was working out, because it was three guys and one girl.
Well, we'll talk about that. Yeah, especially the mission objective as it came to her.
Let's actually try to forget Heston's backside and discuss the film properly.
I'll try.
Exactly. It's been 24 hours and I still can't ignore it. This originally started out as a script written by Rod Serling. His script was rejected because they felt it was going to be too expensive. You can really see the elements of the Twilight Zone in this movie. The concept of taking the familiar and putting it in an unfamiliar landscape that still very much looks like our own, and perpetuating this kind of social commentary on humanity, which I thought was really good. I wish that Serling's script had been retained because he wanted more of a modern society, but that was deemed too expensive, so we get this kind of primitive, Stone Age-esque look at the ape landscape, but they still have stuff like a court system and all of that. So I thought they did well in incorporating Serling's ideas whilst trying really hard to corral the budget.
I would call it the apescape as far as the landscape of apes. But I wonder if that's one of the reasons why, as you put it, actually holds up a little bit more, is because this is a fairly dystopian future. You could say that they're kind of they have a little bit of modern technology, mostly in the realm of firearms. They've done wonderful things with the use of small nets, basically like a Bronze Age with guns kind of a scenario where the apes society has developed. And I actually wonder why, or I wonder if that is one of the reasons why we can watch it even now. And it's not one of those really silly sci-fi things where it's like, well, technology clearly isn't heading in that direction, because in a dystopian situation in 3978, and which I think was another good idea, because sci-fi, as you put it out 40 years. Well, 40 years from now, people will be watching movies, and they'll be like, that's silly.
You can believe that by 3978, the world has been blown up and rebuilt. And that's not a spoiler. That's just kind of the concept that you're going with. Yeah. That, you know, by that point, we have to have remade the world at least once, you know, in that amount of time.
You got to wonder if people will be watching movies in 3978 and they'll be like watching this one and saying,
It's funny how you look at sci-fi as the 70s start, because then it became narrower in its focus. We're just going to show how they take these methods of distraction as a means of enhancing conformity, whereas Planet of the Apes says, no, it's a whole new world by that point. We're not even playing games. We've rebuilt the world in this whole new image.
Twilight Zone element, that's a really good... I didn't even realize that Rod Serling had been involved in it from that point. And like so many things, even though I'm sure, you know, we could all herald the genius of him and when it comes to clever storytelling. Oh, it's like they always say, the original Star Wars, one of the things that made it good was that it wasn't just one person's dream like we mythologize. It was a lot of people arguing and coming up with a solution. And so here we are, as we just said, the change of the script where the apes are a little bit more not quite as advanced, actually may have helped the movie.
We also have Twilight Zone alum Roddy McDowell's in this movie, but it was great seeing Roddy McDowell in Serling pen script in some way, because he did a great episode called People Are Alike All Over, and it's a very similar Twilight Zone episode to this, where you have a space exploration, crash lands on a planet, and Roddy McDowell assumes that the people there are benevolent, but they don't understand humanity as we see it. It's very similar, almost, and it was eerily shocking to watch this and think, well, did we just remake that one? Because both of them have a lot of similarities, although that one is significantly shorter. This came out in April of 68. 1968's best known as kind of the bloodiest, most violent year for the civil rights movement. This is very hard to separate from that, because you have Charlton Heston, who had played Moses, who had kind of epitomized the white savior in films, and he's playing a similar character here in terms of trying to bring intelligence to this primitive group, and they're all apes, and you have a lot of racial connotation going back and forth, and I kept sitting there thinking, I'm unclear whether this is progressive or not in terms of what it's saying about race. And it's very hard to not say it's about race, because it very much has images and dialogue and references that can only be applied to people that were watching it in 68 to what was going on between blacks and whites. So for you, was it something you noticed? Is it something that you think makes sense?
It's something I've thought of before. You know, you take something where there's an obvious, in this case, a species difference between the apes and man, and I think that's where people often focus. But the interesting thing I caught this go around, maybe being a little more mature myself this time, and maybe just listening differently, was that there's an obvious disparity between the orangutans and the chimpanzees, which
yes.
I had either not noticed or had forgotten. And they've built a society that is definitely built on inequality, which makes them, I guess, very human in that way. And there's a couple of quotes that I noticed. Dr. Zayas at one point says, when Taylor is accusing him, accuses Dr. Zayas of having participating in permeating this upside down society, he says, you may well claim society is upside down since you occupy the bottom rung of it, or something to that effect. I thought that was very, very interesting to see. Here's someone who is the status quo old guard. It's like, it's my job to keep people in their place. And so he says, of course you think it's upside down because you're down there. But of course, I'm up here and it doesn't look so upside down from up here.
It's easy to kind of say the movie is perpetuating racism based on the whole damn dirty apes line, which I think would be disingenuous, because there's a lot of pointed critique there's a lot of great disparity between the orangutans and the general ape populace. I also think it's telling from a race perspective that the orangutans are lighter shades than the masses, which are darker. So you have that whole disparity going on, which is still something that's perpetuated in Hollywood today, and with African-American actors being a certain quote-unquote shade of blackness in terms of how that's sold. So there's a lot of pointed critiques about, I think, cinema within that. Heston, I sent you this question. Are we supposed to sympathize with the apes or with Taylor? Because I think there are moments in the movie where you're really sympathizing with none of them at certain moments. You're not really sure who to respect. You can watch this movie from the apes' perspective and see Taylor as kind of this rebel rouser, or you can watch it from Taylor's perspective and see this is completely crazy, but you're never really sure if you're supposed to see anybody as heroic.
Well, one of the things I think is a strength of this story, and it kind of perpetuates, because Taylor's character does not exist very long into the series. Charlton Heston has essentially a cameo in the second movie for the first few minutes, and then it goes on there. And we actually follow the story of Roddy McDowell and Kim Hunter's character, Cornelius and Zira. It kind of perpetuates and goes on there. So the apes are actually full-fleshed characters. They're not just these monstrous creatures or whatever. And part of the thing that I think was effective in world building is that you have Zira obviously has, there's obviously kind of a human rights perspective there from that. And I mean that literally, human rights from the perspective of an ape, just like you might have an animal rights enthusiast in our time. Got her, who's like standing up for these humans who can't talk for themselves, who can't even, as far as we can tell, really have any form of communication. So there's that. So I think the ape characters are more fleshed out than they could have been, which I think is one of the reasons that this is a compelling story that people still talk about all these years later and that we're still making remakes of. And I know that the remakes that show the prehistory of apes rising up essentially it kind of embraces that perspective where, you know, the apes are not just villains. There's a little bit of that challenging to look at and say, whose side am I really on here? And all of the things that Dr. Zaius says about mankind, if mankind was ever in charge, they must have been awful and they must have killed themselves. They actually mirror the beliefs of Taylor himself that he espouses in the beginning. That's why he left.
And you also have this governmental structure, which kind of mimics our own, which is Dr. Zaius wants to essentially ignore the past and say, as long as there's no proof that there was ever another dominant species, we could just kind of move on, which makes the events at the end, without spoiling things right away, when there's talk of a cover-up, the movie kind of ends without resolution, which I think is very bold, because it's not like today where if you make a bare modicum of money, you're usually amounted a sequel. This ends with no, you know, proof that this was going to continue into the franchise it became. So it ends very much like, I hate to throw out Star Wars, but I'm going to. It ends kind of like that, with things unresolved and characters still in peril, and you're not really sure if things are ever going to continue. I mean, that had to scare the pants off of 1968 audiences, because it ends with two characters, take away Heston's character, but you end with two characters pretty much told that they're going to go on trial and they could, you know, be punished for this. Audiences this had to be sitting there like, wait, what?
And you could say this was a fairly draconian society. It's not just like, you might get a fine.
No, you're definitely going to die. It's just going to depend on how badly your death's going to be at that point. We should talk about the gender element in here, because there's about three women in this entire movie. You have Kim Hunter as Zira, you have Linda Harrison who plays Nova, and the unnamed woman that I can't find on IMDb right now who plays Stuart, who is the astronaut that ends up dying without ever having said a single word. She ends up dying. Kim Hunter is kind of the character that she's the only one that talks. I had only seen her in stuff from the 40s and the 50s, Streetcar Named Desire and Seventh Victim. I thought she was really good in this, playing a character that's, you know, covered in makeup, and she's got a couple laugh lines here and there, you know, especially at the end with the infamous kiss.
First on-screen monkey-human kiss, I believe. Take that, Star Trek.
It's definitely not as serious as her previous roles. This isn't on par with something like Towering Inferno, where in order to be in that, your career was on the downhill skids. She does a lot with a role that kind of ends up speaking for all women in this movie, because the only other character we have is Nova, played by Linda Harrison, who actually played Zira when they did test shooting for this movie. She played Zira and James Brolin played Cornelius. Then they ended up wanting Ursula Andress for the role of Nova, and they wanted a couple other women, and no one wanted it. Linda Harrison just happened to be dating Richard Zanuck, who was the producer at the time, and he said, well, we'll put my girlfriend in it. That's what happened. She's beautiful. She wears the nice little strategically ripped outfit very well, but she is essentially embodying the Smurfette principle, which if you have read pop culture, Smurfette was essentially the lone female Smurf in the Smurf television series. The concept of having one woman as a means of repopulating humanity, which is not anything new in the sci-fi community, but it's very difficult to sympathize at all for the character, because she has no personality, no speech. She is literally the sexy lamp. She has no purpose other than breeding, which is what we're told. And I'm not sure if we're supposed to sympathize with her because of that or not, because we literally have nothing to hold on to with that character. So when Heston declares his love for her, or at least some sort of lust or attraction for her, I bought none of it. If this girl dies, we're going to feel anything for her because we don't know her. Same with Stuart in the pod. She dies and we just say, okay, We still have like an hour and 45 minutes left of this movie. We didn't know her. So that was the one disappointing element of this movie, is that the 68 second wave feminism wouldn't really take hold for another couple of years. But this movie is really espousing a future where women have no purpose, or at least a very reduced role in any future society.
And no voice, literally, in this case. It's interesting, the monkeys are much more progressive in that area, as far as at least she holds a doctorate, although we could assume that Stewart was someone of some accomplishment. I think there's a lot of backstory that we just don't know, that was never put into it. And one of the elements that I'd love to know is, what was the mission objective? Be gone forever? Can we kill these four people? Because that's basically what they did. We'll launch you into space, traveling at almost light speed, and then I guess nothing. I mean, humanity won't benefit because you'll just be gone. And I guess you're out there repopulating. And if you're repopulating, the math of three men and one woman doesn't make as much sense as different math would. It almost seems like we need someone for these three guys to get with, which is not inoffensive.
It's a good segue. Heston, as an actor, always kind of espoused himself as a ladies' man, especially as the 60s and the 70s went on, which, if anybody's seen something like The Hawaiians, Heston's character is essentially Taylor. It's hilarious that every woman, even Zira to a small degree, seems drawn to him, whether it's because he's so unique as the one character, ape, so to speak, who can talk. There's supposed to be some sort of virility there that I wasn't really buying.
Yeah, I felt some conflict around the character of Taylor. I felt like he was in some ways a very interesting character, but I wondered if he was more interesting nowadays than he would have been back then. And what I mean by that is he seemed like a very flawed character, almost an anti-hero in a way, to where he's like, screw mankind, I hate them. He's some kind of idealist / renegade. You get the idea that he's kind of a rebel. You kind of want to hear a little bit of that backstory. I'm kind of like, who's this guy who's like, first of all, smoking a cigar recklessly on a spaceship with pure oxygen around him? Also, just like, yeah, I'll turn my back on mankind at the first opportunity. I absolutely don't care. I mean, if you look at the way that he treats Nova, especially at first, not super kindly and not afraid to shove her around, although he doesn't seem to do that after they are somewhat emotionally bonded. A little rough, and also a little rough with his colleagues. When Landon is like, hey, can I take 10 minutes to mourn the passing of humanity? And he's like, no, screw you.
Heston by the 60s had made so many big epic films from the 50s into that. He made Ben-Hur about a decade before this. He also had El Cid, 55 Days at Peking, The Greatest Story Ever Told, Major Dundee, Agony and the Ecstasy. He had all these big movies, and this was just kind of another one. And he eventually would play Mark Antony and Julius Caesar 2 years later, and then The Omega Man and all of that. And Heston always seemed like an odd actor to me, because he made these big movies and was such a big star, yet he looks like Charlton Heston. I just never bought the persona that he kind of sells. And in this, I don't know if I didn't buy him. I bought him as the last man standing. I don't know if I bought him as an astronaut.
I'd see him more as some military guy.
Yes.
Who maybe got in trouble and got drafted for this suicide mission.
There's no sensitivity to his character, which you bring up. He doesn't mourn the loss of humanity. He does, even when he finds that his colleague has been, obviously he's been lobotomized or something, he's mad about it. He's not upset about it. He's irritated by it because it doesn't sell his story.
This is where I wonder if he's more interesting now, because he's more different now, hopefully more different. Because one of the things that is traditionally part of the masculine psyche in our culture, and was definitely raging at that time, was the fact that that's really all you could express. You could express happiness or rage. Those are the emotions that men even still are socialized to have okay. And so trying to kill Dr. Zaius recklessly in the middle of that trial is the appropriate mourning response for a dude. But yet, yeah, I'm with you. It'd be interesting to see a little bit more emotional reaction.
It is a bit funny to watch this with the benefit of hindsight, because the third act, especially when they get out to the cave, Heston has to emphasize how much she wants his guns. What did we think about the other actors? Roddy McDowall, we plays Cornelius. You also have James Whitmore in there. Maurice Evans, who plays Dr. Zaius. I thought everybody was very good. It was hard for me to latch on to any side characters. Cornelius Zira and Dr. Zaius are kind of the only ones that make much of an impact. And I thought they were all very good. Again, especially in that makeup.
You're right. They were the most well-developed. I think Roddy McDowall and Kim Hunter in particular, the physical acting as well, when they kind of move around, it's like, oh, that's probably how a human ape would move around. You know, there's a lot of physical acting there, nonverbal communication, which through that level of prosthetics, with you only have vocal tone and nonverbal behavior to sell emotion, right? And I think they did a good job. I did feel like some connection to Lucius, the nephew. I felt like for someone who wasn't in the movie very long, you got a pretty good handle on, oh, okay, who is this guy? Obviously, Taylor had a connection with him. You're a rebellious young chap like I was, or whatever.
This was originally filmed with James Brolin and Linda Harrison as Cornelius and Zira. It would have been nice to have Linda Harrison do something other than just look beautiful. James Brolin, I think, would have been a very different Cornelius, because Roddy McDowall sells that kind of polished, educated English element that I think would have been lost had James Brolin played it, because James Brolin very much was more of an American earthy type of actor. Would have loved to see what that looks like, but I have to say Roddy McDowall was great. And then Ingrid Bergman was actually offered the role of Zira and turned it down, and she cited it as one of her biggest regrets, because the movie was, she thought, very good, and it was also a big hit. Ingrid Bergman, while being a bit on equal footing with Heston because they were two titans of classic Hollywood, I think it works to Kim Hunter's benefit that she's able to pack a punch and still be physically, you know, she's smaller, she's not as intimidating. I think Bergman would have had too much of that regal bearing.
I couldn't really see anybody else in this, especially as you go on with this couple, and they go into a couple more movies, and then essentially, if I'm not mistaken, which I very well might be, having done no research into the statement I'm about to make, I think Roddy McDowall also plays Cornelius's son, who plays a role in the future of this universe. There were like six different proposed endings, and Charlton Heston actually liked the one that they went with the best. And that was one of the reasons they did use that ending.
Throw out a spoiler warning if you don't want to
know if you want to ending.
This is probably one of the more famous endings in film history, up there with the end of something like Casablanca or Citizen Kane or something like that. But if you don't want to know the end of Planet of the Apes, fast forward about 10 minutes or so, because we are going to spoil it.
Really?
The ending of the movie, you find out, I think without knowing the ending, it's telegraphed fairly obviously in the beginning. You find out that it's been Earth all along, and that apes have taken over, and there is no alternate planet. This is the planet that Taylor has known. I thought the ending being so overutilized in other films and TV shows and just popular culture in general did diminish the overall impact. I'd love to have been an audience member in 68 who had no knowledge of this ending. I still think it worked. It wasn't as confusing. People say this ending is very confusing to them. I was not confused.
Here's the thing. Because we've monkeys haven't evolved to this stage yet that the movie was, but we have maybe evolved in our movie making abilities and our storytelling to where we might be perhaps a bit more sophisticated as an audience, or at least more nitpicky, that's for sure. I will say that a lot of the continuity errors that Amazon Prime will point out, if you rent it on Amazon and watch it streaming with the little notes, they'll point out all these little continuity errors that I bet nobody caught back then, because people weren't watching it over and over and over. And I wonder if one of the things of not being quite so jaded, snarky, maybe, or even just not having seen so many movies with these types of premises, I wonder how surprising it was back then, because you watch it now and you're like, okay, well, we see enough in our media and our sci-fi that we would expect that three, you know, ostensibly trained research scientists, astronauts, you know, who were both military and scientists at the same time, you know, there's some strategic things we would expect them to do. We would expect them to say, boy, the evolution is so specifically like Earth, and the air composition is so specifically like Earth. Somebody would have floated the idea at some point, maybe. that could this be her? Is there a chance? Do we wind up, especially in the beginning when they don't really know where they are exactly? But I wonder if back then they just didn't expect that.
And it's also important to note that by 68, there was really no way of rewatching films because home video was not a thing. So it's something that I point out with the Frankenstein series. You know, the Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein starts essentially where Frankenstein ends. But if audiences who hadn't seen Frankenstein in the however many years it took to bring the sequel, they would have had no memory of that. The movie really benefits in a way from the theater experience and going in cold. The franchise itself, you've seen the sequels, I've seen the reboots, but the franchise is still held up.
Yeah, it's still, especially this first one, is still something that is a real example. Like I say, it's not just a tongue-in-cheek classic label that you apply here. It really is a classic piece of sci-fi. And I think that type of surprise and that type of twist, also some of the things that they put into world building, you've got a real sense that the ape culture had a court system, they have beliefs, they have religion. I mean, they fall a little bit into the thing that all sci-fi falls into, where everybody believes these few scrolls, which, I mean, that's not even how our culture is. But, you know, whatever, that's a dystopian thing that always exists. So it's a little more fleshed out. They have, he stumbles through an ape funeral at one point, and, you know, they didn't have to throw that in the chase scene. So it shows that they had some understanding of the fundamentals of universe and world building that I think that we still rely upon today.
I think it's wonderful that this has an ape funeral, which you can connect it to something like Sunset Boulevard, which also has an ape funeral in it. Overall, I was surprised that I enjoyed this as much as I did, because I am usually kind of the harshest critic with sci-fi because so much of it does age poorly. I enjoyed it in spite of the Heston backside. I thought it was well written. Yeah. I thought it was entertaining.
That made a real impression on you.
It's just going to make Ben-Hur even more difficult to watch in a couple of weeks. But I did enjoy this. I don't know if I'd necessarily go and continue the series, but I enjoyed this a lot. Well, if you have any thoughts on Planet of the Apes, positive or negative, you can email me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com, and I will read them on the next episode. Dwight, I'd like to thank you again for joining me today. Once again, where can fans find and get in touch with you?
Thank you. You can always email me directly at dwighthurst@gmail.com. You can go to my website also, which is just my name, dwighthurst.com. If you go to dwighthurst.com/podcast, it'll have the newest episode of The Broken Brain and some links to some other things. If you're a writer and you want to send us your short story for Amygdala Magazine, issue 2, you can send that anytime between now and Halloween of this year. You can go do that at amygdalazine.com. That's amygdala, like the part of your brain that gets excited, and zine, like the last part of magazine. There's a place there to enter your short story, or you can just listen to that podcast where I talk to writers and storytellers of all kinds.
Though we are running a bit longer than usual, I did want to read our first listener email, courtesy of Keisha. She writes, "Hi, Kristen. First of all, I really enjoyed your episode on Olivia de Havilland. Love the audio clips you featured of her, and your discussion of favorite films with Nora. Between the two of you, you covered almost all of my favorite Olivia films. Three others that I love that weren't mentioned include To Each His Own from 1946, The Strawberry Blonde from 1941, and The Great Garrick from 1937. To Each His Own is a movie I especially hold in high regard as far as Olivia's films go. I watched the film for the first time last month and was really blown away by her performance in it. She goes through a number of stages in her character's life, from an innocent small-town girl to a worn, middle-aged businesswoman who watches her son grow up from afar. I rewatched it on TCM again on Friday and was still in awe of what she did in the film. Unfortunately, like Hold Back the Dawn, it hasn't been released on DVD, but perhaps with Olivia's centennial, it'll get a proper release somewhere in the near future. Anyway, she fully deserved her Oscar win for that role, which was extra rewarding for her, as it was the first film she made after winning her lawsuit against Warner Brothers. Thanks again for putting together a wonderful episode on an equally wonderful actress. Looking forward to hearing more. thank you so much, Keisha, for your email. It was so great to actually have some great feedback from listeners who are apparently enjoying what I'm doing. But of course, that is going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz@gmail.com or visit me at my official site where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. I still don't have a website for this show specifically or a Facebook Twitter account. If that's something you would be interested in, you can just let me know. If not, we'll just stick with what works. Next time, I'll be joined by another amazing guest to honor TCM's Summer Under the Stars series in August. Until next time.